Are you registered to vote? Headcount is a nonpartisan organization that works with the music and entertainment industry to get fans to vote. To update or check your voter registration status, go to headcount.org, where you'll find all the information you need to be ready for Election Day.
Headcount tours with musicians to help concert attendees register to vote, but you don't need to leave your house to register or to get voting info. Register to vote by visiting headcount.org. Hello, and welcome to another episode of
Mixtape Memories.
I'm Matt Hart-Spade.
And I'm Jenners.
And today we have a very special guest, Peter Silberman, who I'm sure you know as the principal songwriter, frontman of The Antlers. He's also a revered solo artist, and he's one half of Spatial Relations, who just released their debut record, Talking to Strangers, the companion album. So the last time I saw you was for the 10th anniversary of Hospice. There was sort of this mini tour in the U.S. and I think possibly elsewhere as well. You and the rest of the band were revisiting this album that has meant so much to so many people. So how was it to kind of revisit it in an acoustic way? And can you describe that experience from last year?
Yeah, happily. It was kind of a dream tour experience. We were traveling with very minimal gear, which is always nice when you're used to carting around a lot of equipment, because it was basically two guitars and a snare drum and ourselves. And so that just made us kind of light on our feet, which was great. But it was also just a really lovely group of people. It was myself and Michael Lerner, who's been our drummer for a very, very long time since the beginning, and as well as Tim Mislock, who toured with us back in the day, and he and I have remained very close and played a lot of music together in the years since. So it was very smooth entry into reinterpreting these songs in a new style and heading back out on the road and just having a lot of natural chemistry to begin with. And then as far as the shows themselves, they were wonderful. I mean, it's a very different experience touring an album that people are very familiar with and care about, have a existing relationship with already, versus trying to sell people on new songs. Mm-hmm. You just felt a lot of love in these shows and a lot of enthusiasm. And we also got to put on these shows we had so much control over what the vibe was and what the venues were like. We chose really smaller rooms, a lot of theaters and churches, all seated shows, very different than the kinds of shows we were playing when we first toured the album in 2009 and 10.
Yeah, the room in Brooklyn, I believe it was a church in Brooklyn Heights. Yeah, really stunning room.
Yeah, that was the First Unitarian Church in Brooklyn. Yeah, Brooklyn mm-hmm. Heights.
Mm-hmm. So we were hoping to go all the way back to your early music memories when you were a kid. And I was wondering what you were into and if you could remember like the first albums you purchased, the first mixtapes that you either made or received. What are your earliest memories of really getting into music very seriously?
Well, there was always a lot of music playing in my house growing up. My dad's a guitar player, and he was always, playing a lot of Clapton and Hendrix and Beatles and more kind of like country and the like. So I remember that stuff from a very early age, and that was some of the music I learned how to play guitar to. But I think once I had once I started developing my own taste, all of that was definitely in there. But I was also, raising myself on MTV, and watching tons of MTV and music videos, and the radio was always on. And I don't remember it wasn't K-Rock back then in New York, but it was. I don't think it was. It was some other like alternative rock station, plus like Z100, which was right. Playing all the pop greats, but also all the alt rock that was super popular at the time. So that all made its way in there. I think my first albums were cassettes, and they would have been, well, I think my first ever cassette was a cassette single of the Four Seasons, What a Night. Wow. I just like loved that song when I was little. I don't know why.
That's such a classy first tape.
I know. It's really like, it's kind of a left field choice for, I don't know, I must have been like 8 maybe.
None.
And I just love that song. I used to listen to it on the school bus. And but, you know, among those, or in addition to that one, Nirvana, like those were my first tapes. So Nevermind and In Utero. And I remember it being a really big deal. I remember calling the local CD store. And this was, I guess, once I started buying CDs, but I placed an order on the phone to pick up Incesticide. And I felt like really like badass for getting it because it was parental advisory and like they shouldn't have been, mm-hmm. you know, they shouldn't have been selling it to me. Same with like the Offspring, Smash.
Sure.
I remember like loving that album, and that was among like my group of friends when I was little. That was a big deal because there was that one song in the middle of the record where all the music stops and he just like shouts a string of profanities. And you like listen to it in secret, and I had friends whose parents found out about it and took the CD away from them. And
I never would have pegged you as an Offspring fan.
Oh, right. Yeah. I loved Smash. Yeah, Green Day.
Mm-hmm.
God, who else would it have been at the time? I mean, it was just all over the map for me. But I think Nirvana was probably my big favorite at that time. And that was the first songwriter I listened to seriously. And I was really young. I was like, I must have been about 8 or 9. But I think that was the first thing that I responded to on like an emotional level, even mm-hmm. being that young.
I can't imagine what it's like to listen to Nirvana at that age.
It's dark. It's a dark thing to listen to as an 8-year-old. But he had also, like, I watched a lot of MTV, and I knew that he had, like, it was all over the news that he had just killed himself. So I was aware of this darkness, at least as much as an 8-year-old can comprehend that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you remember making like mixtapes back in the day or receiving them?
I remember trying to make mixtapes and kind of messing it up and like having the songs not line up the right way and overlap each other. But I think I was like I was more like a completist. Like I liked the album. But I definitely, I think I had mixtapes made for me. Like my sister made mixtapes. She was like 4 years older, so she was of very much of that generation. And I made mix CDs once I had a CD burner, but that was, you know, we're fast forwarding and a few years into the future.
What about some of like your aughts memories? Because that, you know, that was like, I always say it's like a moment in time, that early aughts New York scene. And then you kind of growing up around New York, like what's like your perspective on all of that?
Well, I was in high school between 2000 and 2004, and so most of and I grew up about an hour north of the city, so like I had an awareness of the city but not really a ton of awareness about what was going on down there, except for the bigger things that broke through. So like Is This It made it to my high school, but it like not a lot of kids were listening to it. Mm-hmm. And to give you perspective, like not a lot of kids in my high school, like I was strange for listening to Radiohead in my high school, which seems crazy. But yeah, things like the Strokes and Interpol made their way to our high school. The Rapture probably did. But they were still like, they were considered very alternative to what most kids were listening to. And I think what was, you know, big in my high school was Dave Matthews Band, jam bands, screamo. And that was like kind of a heyday for that, for screamo in particular and in that region, because so much of that was coming out of New Jersey and Long Island.
Right.
So if there was anything resembling a scene near where I grew up, it would have been that. You know, up in, like, Poughkeepsie at the Chance. And, and yeah, a lot, like I said, a lot of bands coming from Jersey and Long Island, and a lot of bands in my town and surrounding towns imitating that stuff.
Going back to what you were saying about wanting to listen to the album in its entirety in full, it doesn't surprise me that you say that, because when I listen to your records solo or with the Antlers or with this new release, with this new project, I feel like they are very much it's a full unit. It's not as much of like a singles type of party. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's definitely accurate. And I think I probably gravitated towards albums from a really young age, and it informed everything that came after.
Could we talk about early Antlers days? Like, I feel like when it was just you, and it was you brought your acoustic guitar, and you would play like Union Hall and Cake Shop, Matchless. A lot of these venues may or may not exist anymore. What were your memories before the Antlers broke in sort of a major way?
It was dark. I mean, I think that period of time in the city, like I moved to the city in 2006. It seemed like a few movements had just passed. Like the freak folk thing had just kind of just passed. There was still a lot of like residue from it. And same with, you know, like the, I don't know, I guess the post-punk thing had kind of not passed, but like there was a peak that happened. And I was the stuff that I was making wasn't very New York, and it wasn't very Brooklyn. And I remember trying to figure out how to go about playing shows and where I would fit in there, because I felt like what I was doing was too like earnest for the Sidewalk Cafe, but it was too weird for the Bitter End, and I also just didn't know anybody. So I would do as much digging as I could online, just, I mean, basically through Brooklyn Vegan and probably both of your sites, and that was sort of where I got my ideas about where these venues were and what shows were happening and which places seemed like they might be a good fit. But it was hard to book a show at one of the, what I considered like the legit spaces. And I remember my first few shows were, you know, basically venues where there are never any people there whatsoever. They technically have a stage, but like there's no audience. They only book local acts, and those are local acts that don't have anybody coming to the shows. I'm not really sure how that business model was supposed to work for them, because a lot of the bars never seemed that popular either. But and so those shows are always terrible. like pretty much without a doubt. I won't get into naming venues because it's not, you know.
Yeah.
Support the venues right now, but
yeah, exactly.
But it really, I think my like thinking at the time was, I needed to get my music out to you folks, and you know, hope that would get some of the word around, and a lot of you were putting on shows here and there. And that just seemed like the path for me at that stage. I think it was probably Pat Duffy who first put me on at a show, and he was like such a huge supporter early on, and such a lifeline when it was like so hard to book a show to get anybody to come to.
Pop-Tarts.
Yeah, Pop-Tarts. Yeah, but it was even a long road to get to like blog hosted shows at the time. But I do remember that like most of the venues ignored me in those days, but Cake Shop and Union Hall were the two venues that I considered really cool that actually gave me a shot. And it meant a great deal to me at the time. Even if those like first couple of shows I couldn't get anybody there but like my family or a couple friends. I love the vibe of those spaces. Like Cake Shop was just like its own little cave, and so like you could play a show there to nobody and still feel okay about yourself. And then
that's a cool scene.
Yeah, and I mean, I also just appreciated Andy for putting me on bills, and like when I would reach out to them and see that like some like interesting band was coming through and ask if he would throw me on the bill, that he would. And same with Skippy at Union Hall. Like, and that was just such a beautiful space too, that that I always felt like honored to play there. And especially Union Hall had acts come through that I would be like, I would be surprised that a band that I considered kind of big would be coming through and playing there. And again, like Skippy put me on the bill, and I don't know how much it did to like advance anything for me, but it was a good feeling, and it felt like progress.
I mean, I think it's so cool when the like in-house talent buyer supports bands like that, or like up and coming, and like they kind of play matchmaker a little bit. I think it's really, you may not know, but like, I think that it does do something, because it's already like kind of putting you in with other kind of known bands and just establishing you a little bit more in whatever way the perception is, mm-hmm. you know. And then you get to maybe somebody will arrive early, get to get drinks, and they'll see your band. I don't know if that happens as much anymore. I feel like there's so many like statistical numbers that people like, you know, judge bands by these days. You know, it's like, how many likes do you have, how many followers do you yeah. have, and is it really about, do I really love this band and I want to throw them on a bill?
I feel like it must have been MySpace back then, like that was yeah. that was really the only metric you could go by. But yeah, I mean, it was a really cool thing to feel supported like that. And yeah, the dream would always be like, maybe like I'll get to play on one of these CMJ showcases, which Matt, I believe you put me on one of yours at pianos mm-hmm. back in the day. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like, it's a game. It was a game of inches, and you just hope that something starts to make like an inch of difference along the way.
How was it once things started to click and all the buzz was being garnered and the room started to get a little bigger? Was that unnerving? Did it seem right as you kind of graduated as a band from, say, you know, Mercury to Bowery to Webster, for example?
I mean, it was mind-blowing when it happened. And in my, like, when I first moved to the city and I first started trying to make something of this. Oh, and I should give a shout-out to Jezebel Music, if you guys remember that entity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they also were among the first to like give me a shot and put me on a showcase, and that was that meant the world to me. Gabe was a super sweet guy and very supportive. But anyway, I was saying, it was so it was mind blowing that was happening, because when I moved to the city and was trying to get things going and playing all these shows, like my pie in the sky dream was that I got to play the Mercury Lounge.
Yeah,
and by the time we actually got booked there, I think our first show there was, it was like we were first of three opening for the Cave Singers.
Oh, I remember them.
Yeah, they were great. I remember just being like, okay, I like, I can die happy now. I got to play the Mercury. And but from there it started to happen really fast, and suddenly we were playing Mercury and selling it out, and then suddenly we were first of three on a show at Bowery opening for Vetiver, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting like last minute calls to open other shows. And I remember the craziest one was in, this was 2009, and there was a lot of hype building, and we were, every day brought something new to us that we were just like, I can't believe what's going on right now. We still hadn't, like, we'd been on very unsuccessful tours up until that point, but hadn't, the momentum was really just starting to build. And I remember getting a very last minute call that the show that evening at Webster Hall needed a first of three, because their first of three had to drop out. The first of three was Cymbals Eat Guitars. and the headliner was The Walkmen, and Beach House was opening for them.
Crazy lineup.
Yeah, that is a crazy lineup.
Yeah, and we got the call at maybe like 3 in the afternoon, and I was at work. I was working at LPR at the time, and Darby was home. Michael was like at the post office, and we all just had to call each other and be like, can we make this happen? Like, everyone, like, we need to go to wherever all of our gear was at the time. It was probably at Darby's house. We need to scramble, get all our stuff together, get to Webster immediately and do this. And it was the biggest show we had played by far. And we somehow did it. Like, I left work early, and we all rushed home, got ourselves together, got all of our gear, went back to the venue, and then played this show. And I remember seeing some of my friends in the audience who were there to see The Walkmen, who saw me come out on stage and were shocked and were just like, what the hell is going on here? Amazing. So it was all a whirlwind. Once it started to pick up like that, we suddenly seemed like we were light years away from where we had been less than a year before that, playing empty rooms. It happened fast after going very slowly for a long time.
Yeah, it did feel like kind of a fast thing, because if I remember correctly, Hospice was self-released, and then it was put out by French Kiss.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like once it was re-released, it every day it was like, yeah, it was a bigger and bigger kind of mountain. Yeah,
that's how it felt. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting too, because I had been like working the blogs for a while at that point, and gotten good like pickup here and there. It never translated to people coming out to shows. And then something changed, like in that spring of 2009. And I don't really know what it was that changed it. You know, it might have been NPR. It might have been just the album itself circulating, and it going from being like, here's like a buzzy local band, to like, there's something of magnitude here.
That Tiny Desk performance was pretty great. So I think, you know, you might have captured the magic of the NPR reach, you know.
Yeah, it was an even tinier desk back then.
It was before they would invite pop stars, really, to play Tiny Desk.
Oh, for sure, you know? For sure. Yeah.
But they just re-released that Tiny Desk.
Yeah, I saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. It's a trip to go back that far in the past and see that
Did
stuff.
Did you get a bunch of responses after they reposted it?
I think so. I mean, and this kind of ties back to the anniversary tour. As much as this is like, it was nostalgic for a lot of people, and I think probably seeing the Tiny Desk reposted is nostalgic, we met a lot of young people on tour who, like, were getting into the record for the first time, and they weren't around in 2009 for that first wave of it. And so it was like a new generation discovering it, which was, you know, made me feel a little old in a really nice way. But so I think we're finding that, you know, there's people who this record was important to when they were in their early 20s, and now they're in their 30s, and their life has moved on, but, you know, maybe they still have a special place in it, but maybe they've like turned their kids onto it, which is
trippy.
Cool.
Yeah,
I could see that.
More kids in high school now who are just mining the past, and the way that people consume music now, it makes it very easy.
Mm-hmm. I could see how your vocals could be like little lullabies.
I always was wondering if it's like totally surreal to have people come up to you after a show, I guess particularly around Hospice, because it was such a groundbreaking release, and they have Hospice-related tattoos and Hospice-related stories, and they're kind of like telling you these moments in their lives that were so shaped by the album. How does that feel to like kind of take that all in as a performer who wrote it, not maybe anticipating that all these people would be so touched by it?
Well, when I made it, I didn't anticipate anybody hearing it. So that was an immediate adjustment when it first started to gain some momentum and find an audience. So when I actually started meeting people in person who were telling me about their connection to it, it was disorienting. And it took me a second to recognize that it's okay for somebody to have a connection to this thing for different reasons than I do. In fact, it's probably better that way, that it can be more open to interpretation. But, you know, ultimately it's flattering, and it's the it is the kind of thing that makes me feel like I've like put something good out there into the world, and makes, you know, it's fulfilling beyond like any other measure of success. Creatively, like, of course, always wanting to move forward and do more, but to have had some kind of impact on people in that, with that kind of depth, just makes me feel like mission accomplished.
Definitely.
I also enjoyed your solo album that you put out a few years ago.
Thanks.
Just in terms of like what's going on now, right now with the world and our lives, re-listening to the song New York, like, really kind of just like stood out to me. It's almost like recontextualized it for me, listening to it now. How do you feel about stuff that you've written like that? Do you see it in a new context as well? Or like, do you experience stuff that you've written in the past in new ways?
Definitely. I think the more space I and time that, the more space I have from something I've made and the more time that passes, the more I'm able to reinterpret it. You know, that solo album, Impermanence, was inspired by a very specific experience I had losing my hearing and having this phase of a couple months where sound was excruciating for me, and my senses of perception were all out of whack, and it was a really disturbing experience. But this album came out of it, and the whole thing became kind of a meditation on the temporariness of life and of, you know, the physical body and of, you know, in general, temporary nature of reality. And that has continued to be true for me in different ways. And I think the experience of the last several months, as the entire world has changed, you know, that idea continues to ring true of things that you grow accustomed to and think of as stable pillars of life are not so stable. And it doesn't take much to completely wipe them out. That song in particular, you know, it was written about living in a really loud city when sound is painful for you. But, you know, I haven't been down to the city since it shut down. But reports from all my friends who are still down there, it's, you know, it sounds like it was pretty eerie and a very different kind of place. And I could see that song taking on new meaning. In a weird time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you just released an album as Spatial Relations, which is a collaboration between yourself and Nick Principe from Port St. Willow. And it is really stunning. And you know what I find great about it is that I love both of your voices so, so much. But this album is pretty much exclusively instrumental, correct?
Yeah.
I just find it really stunning and kind of meditative in a way.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, our voices are nowhere on this. So it's we're excited that it's out and that we managed to find a way to turn this sizable body of work for one project into a cohesive album, what I think of as a cohesive album.
How did that all come about?
We started a scoring collaboration a couple of years ago, and largely have worked in doing some scoring for podcasts and some theme writing for podcasts. But through a friend of ours was producing the audiobook for Malcolm Gladwell's book that was released last year, Talking to Strangers. And he thought of us as somebody who could be a good candidate for scoring it. And the process, you know, he brought us into it, and our process was generating like a massive library of sounds and ideas, some of them more ambient and atmospheric, and then others more band-centric. Nick playing drums and me on bass, and then both of us covering a lot of other ground as far as synths and samples and loops and guitars and things like that. So we provided them with this huge library, and Alex Lewis, the producer who brought us in, he was responsible for placing all of this throughout the audiobook, which is an enormous task.
I'm sure.
And yeah, but we were able to take those recordings, many of which were like a minute long, and develop them into longer ideas, more fully fleshed out, things that move a little bit more, feel a little more song-like. Yeah, we spent a couple months last summer developing the whole thing into an album that you would actually want to put on, either something that, you know, if you've listened to the audiobook, something to let you kind of stay in that world without necessarily rereading it or re-listening to it. So it really does act as a companion album in that way, but I think it can be separated from it as well. You don't have to have read the book to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I've heard you... you and Nick perform together, you know, on stage and on record and whatnot. But even when your voices are not on the release, it's so apparent that there is just this kind of symbiosis with the two of you. And I guess it's because you guys go way back. Weren't you childhood friends, or am I dreaming this?
Oh, yeah. We've been,
you go up way back.
We've been friends since we were about 11, and we've been making music together about that long, too. We started off... you know, making songs in Cakewalk when we were that age, like on his family computer, and then we started a band, which kind of ran the gamut of styles from, you know, like acoustic singer-songwriter stuff that you would expect from 13-year-olds to, you know, we were a pop-punk band for a little bit. We were kind of like a little proggy for a while, a little bit of a Radiohead ripoff here and there, but yeah, it was us and another player who's not part of our collaboration anymore. But we've been making music together and writing music and writing songs together for a very, very long time. So we have a musical vocabulary with each other. It's very intuitive. And even since our high school band broke up and we, you know, went on to college and went on to our separate music careers, we've continued making music together, a lot of it improvised, some of it recorded, and Spatial Relations was the first container we've had for this material since we were teenagers, really, something to kind of focus our energies and create finished music, or finish music that we've been creating, because a lot of things, you know, sit in a state of infancy or half-completion. Can be surprisingly hard to finish music. Like, I think we've always been good about generating the ideas, but the editing, the compiling, the development, that's taken a little time for us to get the knack of. But so far, so good. We've created a lot of music in the last couple of years since formalizing this entity. And it's nice to have this first release out now. First of many, I hope.
Yeah, I was going to ask what comes next. Is it going to be more kind of soundtracking and podcasts, or what does the future hold for Spatial Relations beyond this album?
Yeah, I think the primary focus is scoring, and so most of the work that he and I are doing together is scoring for different clients. So you know, we're just wrapping up a couple episodes of another podcast right now, and have some more audiobook work in our future. So depending on each scenario and whether or not we're able to retain some rights to release it. Sometimes those things are just bought outright by the client. Other times we retain the rights and we turn it into something more musical, something more in the album format. So we are hoping to, from this album, continue to make more of these, and sometimes they'll be attached to a commissioned project, but sometimes it might just be for the sake of making something. It'd be really nice to get to that point sometime soon. We've got kind of the infrastructure in place to put things out, so it's nice, and I think for us to have a formal way of making instrumental music outside of our individual projects, which are very personal and very individualistic, this has become a really nice way for us to collaborate.
Do you think your collaboration would always be instrumental, or would you consider adding like your vocals to it?
It's not off the table. The way that I tend to think of it is like if I'm if my vocals are involved, then it doesn't become the Antlers necessarily, but it becomes of that world. And I think for him, when his vocals are involved, it becomes Port St. Willow. So it's a bit of a different creature to do that, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's off the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just wondering, like, when people commission you for these, like, theme musics or, you know, soundscape work in these podcasts or audiobooks, do they ever ask for your audio, like, your vocal audios? Or just because it's so, like, it's so unique and pleasant that maybe some people would like want that, versus the instrumental.
Well, the funny thing is that podcasts and audiobooks are just a very different, it's just a totally separate world from the music world. And so I would say most of these people that we're working with are not familiar with the Antlers. Like, they're not familiar with my band. So they, they think of, or with Nick's project, so they think of us as a scoring production duo.
Got it. Yeah.
And which is kind of by design.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of like the idea of keeping it separate. Yeah.
Totally.
Should we hop into repeat, Skip? I think so.
Sure.
Sounds good.
So the first release is Yola Tangos and Then Nothing Turns Itself Inside Out from 2000. Peter, what's your relationship with this release and any certain memories from it?
I have a lot of memories of this album, but the first one that comes to mind was when I first moved to Williamsburg. And I was it was while I was making Hospice, actually. And I had two roommates who were both DJs. And if you remember that aspect of the North Brooklyn scene in 2007, 2008, those parties were a big part of it, what were they called? Like Misshapes and Trash and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'm sure you were
Tiz
there.
Was.
I was there all the time.
Yeah. So anyway, they were DJs in that world, and they were basically nocturnal. So it was really, like, I had a lot of trouble sleeping in that apartment, and I found a couple records around that time that I would just put on every single night to fall asleep. And that was one of them. And I used to listen to it every single night, and it got me there. And then I've never stopped listening to it. Really, it's just like more than most albums that I've loved. It just has like infinite replay value for me.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned sleeping, because when I was re-listening to this album, I mean, I listen to this album once every, I don't know, a couple years, but I haven't listened to it recently, and I was listening to it the other day on the couch, and I kind of dozed off. And I don't mean that in, like, a bad way. I mean, it kind of puts you in this state, you know?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who makes pretty sleepy music, I take it as a compliment if somebody falls asleep during a show or while listening to it, so.
Jen, yeah. What about you?
Yeah, no, I feel the same way, like, it has just a pleasant vibe to it overall, so it's like super easy to listen to. But yeah, I think some songs for me stand out more than others. I don't know, they're just like, they're an easy band to listen to for me.
I have a lot of love for them. I think I like their, I just love what they've been about for so long. You know, musically, like, they're so, they have such a wide range.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very diverse, but I always find them very comforting, and like they're never, never trying too hard, but without like a slacker mentality, like very like they're putting a lot of effort and care into what they do, but they also don't seem like they take themselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that sense too.
Yeah, even no matter what kind of level of success they've had over the years, I feel like they're always, they just seem like down to earth or like no egos. And I think that comes across in the music too.
Yeah, like, for sure.
What were some of your favorites from this album?
I have a lot of them, but I mean, I think that the track that I would choose as my repeat is Night Falls Over Hoboken, which that song, I can really just listen to it over and over again. I find it very soothing. I also used to listen to it often when we'd be coming home from a tour and be, you know, driving back into the city, and it would usually be nighttime, and it just always felt like very appropriate. It'd be like 2 or 3 in the morning, and something about it just kind of fit. But it's really fit into different phases of my life as well. I just like, I find it just like kind of hypnotizing, and it just eases anxiety. That would be one of them. I always love Let's Save Tony Orlando's House.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I partly loved it because it's a classic Simpsons reference. But yeah, just like a great beat and a lovely song.
I like Georgia's vocals too.
Yeah, me too. I just like love to hear her sing anytime. Madeline is a great one. But You Can Have It All. That was actually, I think, one of the first Yola Tango songs I ever heard. Kind of going back to mixtapes, my sister made me a mix CD when I was in high school, and it had a bunch of things I'd never heard before, like a bunch of Yola Tango songs from that album, and from I Can Hear the Heart Beating as one, and Magnetic Fields, and Ween, and Jim O'Rourke, and all this stuff that I was just not hip to yet.
Cool older sister.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
So key, I think, when you can have that kind of influence. I always wish I had like an older sibling who taught me, but luckily I had friends that were cool. What about you, Matt?
So yeah, I love this album, and for me, my first introduction to Yola Tango was when a friend of mine put Autumn Sweater on a mixtape for me, my freshman year of college, I would say. And then I slowly started to get really into them as I was, you know, had my college radio show and whatnot. And then I saw them for the very first time a few weeks after 9/11 at the 9:30 Club in D.C., which is where I feel like all roads lead with me sometimes, is that space and the Black Cat. And yeah, for me, like, my favorite is actually Cherry Chapstick. And I realize that in a sense it's kind of an anomaly on the album because it's kind of maybe more fast-paced and a little more like typical indie rock. But for some reason, I just remember kind of grooving to that song a lot. But I really do appreciate the more mellow moments on this album as well. And I think the opening track is really stunning and sets the tone really well. So yeah, there's really very little I would skip on this release. I mean, the only one I would skip actually is Hoboken, just because for me, the song is like 16, 17 minutes long.
It is, and crazy. And I feel long, like for sure.
The buildup of it for me isn't worth the payoff or something like that. Like, I feel like on Spiritualized, Ladies and Gentlemen, the last song, Cop Shoot Cop, is also about 17 minutes long.
That's a great one.
I love that song. And I just kind of feel like, for me, that song builds in a way that kind of beautifully ends the album. And I think this is a beautiful album closer as well. It just doesn't personally move me as much.
Totally fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm going to put this song on my next road trip back from upstate New York and see it, see how it goes. Because you always want like a really long song that doesn't break up all your GPS directions.
Exactly.
But my repeat was also Every Day, the opening track. I just thought it was like moody as fuck and haunting, and I just love the vibe of it in general. And I also did like You Can Have It All, and I went back and just for shits and giggles, like, listen to the original from George McRae, and, like, they really did, like, their own twist on the song with all the acapella, and I just, it, like, you know.
The original is also an amazing song.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, but it's, like, totally different.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and this song always pops up on my playlist and stuff, so I don't know, it has a good vibe to it, summer vibe. But I love that you guys, I guess, Peter, your skip was like Matt's repeat.
Yeah, we inverted.
We did. Yeah, well, I really like Cherry Chapstick. Because I have to choose a skip on this record, I chose that one. But it's because it is the outlier. And like I said, I used to listen to this album to fall asleep. But when that song mm-hmm. would come on, it would wake me up and scare the shit out of me. So if I had to give it a skip, it's because of that. But I would put it on, like, Painful, or I'd put it on I Can Hear the Heart Beating as one.
Yeah, it might have fit better on that one, yeah.
But I like that they decided, they're like, we're going to make our mellowest record, but then we're going to put one noise jam in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They couldn't help themselves.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. Sometimes I skip the first track, even though I love it, because mm-hmm. I find it very, like, creepy, and sometimes I need to start with Our Way to Fall, just because it's so like warm and comforting and soothing that I'm like, I just need that right away. But that first track is like one of the best Yola Tango songs, I'd say.
Yeah, they're always consistent. Our second repeat skip that we're going to play with is The Books, released from 2005, Lost and Safe. I always feel like The Books were doing their own kind of thing and never really followed any trends. And love or hate them, I think everything they've created was always really interesting. I mean, I would never consider myself like a mega, mega fan, but I do remember this album just really being kind of attached to for a couple months when it was released. Peter, what are your thoughts on this one?
So, like, my earliest memories of it were being a radio DJ at Skidmore College in 2005. And they, like probably most radio stations, had the hot box of all the new releases. And they're like, please, please play things from here. And I remember checking that one out because The Books on a tiny liberal arts campus is like the kind of band that you hear all the most interesting people talking about.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I got to see what this is about. And I think I just loved it right away. And it was at a time where, like, there was also, you know, the big things on campus were, like, Animal Collective and The Microphones and The Books. I would play tracks from this album on my radio show pretty much every week. But they also, the radio station brought The Books to perform at the college, and it's definitely one of, like, the best shows I've ever seen. It was, I don't know if either you had the chance to see them, but it was, like, this like, perfectly synced, it was, like, basically, to the extent that they sample, they had a perfectly synced film that was all, like, samples of film.
Oh.
Completely synced to the audio, and it kind of blew my little mind at the time. And then they played like ballads and played more instrumentally, and that was beautiful too. It was like in a really tiny room, and it felt very much of the moment for me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The visuals must have really added to just the experience of listening to all these like samples and like, you know, kind of spaced out moments in the music.
The visuals were like tailored to each sample, like each word that was sampled, like very, it was like an associated image for whatever the word in question was, and so meticulously edited. I was just watching it trying to understand how they did it, how anyone could possibly put that together.
Mm-hmm. No, that sounds cool. That, for some reason, reminds me of when I saw The Knife on the Silence Shout tour in like 06 or something. And I feel like every song, there was some, it actually was kind of creepy. Like, there were different, like, glow-in-the-dark animals that would pop up and different things on the screen. And obviously, they're dressed kind of kooky. And, yeah, that was incredible. But when an artist is able to sync things like that, I think it's pretty, it really makes for a magical performance.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I loved about this record is that they I feel like for the first time really incorporated their own vocals in, so it wasn't just the samples. And I actually lean toward enjoying those songs more than the ones with the samples, because I feel like there's more of like a human element. There's something a little more to hold on to.
It's a little less like collaged that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I gravitated more towards those songs that were just more traditionally musical versus like the sampled music. The music with like a lot of samples really reminded me of like being in an art gallery and putting on the headphones and then that's like what you would hear. It's like, it felt very like educational in a way or something, or like a commentary on something. You know, for repeat, I don't think either of you picked this, but I chose None But Shining Hours. I just like the melodic way it was when I was looking at the lyrics here, because I'm like, I always look up lyrics to songs that kind of like I gravitate towards. There were a lot of words I didn't know the meanings of, and I had to look them up, and I was like, I instantly feel smarter. So yeah, like listening to them makes me feel smarter in a way.
I like that.
Yeah, I think I would probably repeat Smells Like Content and An Owl With Knees, which, like I was saying earlier, have a little more of their actual vocals. And Peter, what would you repeat?
I have to remember what the first track is called again. Is that A Little Longing Goes Away?
A Little Longing, yeah.
Yeah, I love that track as an introduction. It really like sounds like springtime to me. And like early spring, like April, when it's like starting to rain, but getting a little warmer, especially like in the city, because I really like continued listening to that record a lot once I moved. And I remember walking around in like the springtime in the city and feeling that kind of like those just like sort of rainy days. Mm-hmm. And I think there is even that line in there. It's like enjoy Central Park in spring. That just makes you feel like they're, you know, they're watching what you're doing. that one, I think, I don't know how to pronounce it, but vote dig for Kloppergopt or something.
Right, the Danish titled.
Yeah. I used to play that on my radio show a lot. And I love, there's like a kind of, there's a moment like halfway through the track where this like tremoloed voice comes through the mix and is just like very, very heavenly to me. It's a really beautiful effect.
Yeah, that, I was reading that song is based on like a folklore or something like that of the Jabberwocky.
Oh yeah.
So, it's interesting where they kind of pull their little bits and pieces when it comes to their music. It's like it's almost like you want to look up what the inspiration came from for every song, just because it's a whole story, you know.
I find sometimes like I accidentally encounter those samples. Like, I think actually the other day, and maybe it's what made me think of this doing this album for this. But my partner and I were watching the second season of Fargo, and one of the characters quoted the Jabberwocky, and nice. I was like, "What is this? Like, why do I know this?" And she's like, "It's the Jabberwock." I was like, "Right, oh yeah, from the books." And similarly, I was like a few years ago listening to a lot of Alan Watts recordings, and there's a ton of that across the books records.
You know, for some reason, when I was listening to this album, I was sensing like bits of Kraftwerk, and I don't know why exactly. But I guess because Kraftwerk obviously did things with their vocals being repeated over and over again and samples here and there. And I don't know, I just kind of got a Kraftwerk vibe from certain songs that I didn't initially kind of feel when the album came out. But yeah, for me, the only one I would really skip if I were forced to, I feel like this album flows really well. Each song kind of blends into the next one really well. But I would probably skip Venice, which is about 2 minutes long. Mm. That's the one that it's kind of like this American reporter talking to Salvador Dali and asking kind of like, he's kind of fawning over him and asking kind of like a couple silly questions. I don't know. I just feel like there's the text encompasses the entire song and the music, the actual instrumental is kind of buried a bit. So it's really, I don't know. I wish there was a little more breathing room in that song. If the conversation had been dragged out amongst a 5-minute track and there was actually 3 minutes of instruments and books kind of playing around, I think I would enjoy it more than just kind of the straightforward text.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the samples make it kind of hard to really get into the track because you're mostly focused on the conversation. I didn't pick that one, though. I picked It Never Changes to Stop as my skip. It's because, I don't know, there's something about the audio of that dude in that song that really rubbed me the wrong way.
Oh, me
very,
too.
Like, Trump-esque or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely my skip, too. For the same reason, because the disciplinarian or whoever they are just, yeah, just freaks me out to listen to it. It's very jarring.
Mm-hmm.
Not into it.
The banjo is really nice in it. Like, the instrumentation is very pretty.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how sometimes, like, the sample or the audio can affect your experience of the music, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, like, what they were trying to, like, get out of that, you know, by doing this. Because it's, like, I can't imagine anyone would be like, this is great. This would be a great thing to listen to. Maybe they were trying to make you uncomfortable or, like, bring that idea of discomfort in there.
Mission accomplished.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many albums from those eras to choose from. I feel like these have endured the test of time for me in the ways that maybe some others have not.
Yeah,
definitely when we revisit certain albums from the 90s and aughts, like, they just have not aged well. But at the time, they meant everything to us, you know?
Yeah, it's really amazing how that happens. The things that had the most, like, excitement around them sometimes have the shortest lifespan.
Yeah.
Especially when time changes things in the context of things, I think. You know, when you're younger, you're just all about the moment, you know, the immediate moment, and then going out and having fun. And definitely, like, now as I'm older, like, I gravitate to the kind of softer, gentle, like,
yeah.
I'm not out there listening to, like, abrasive music too much.
Yeah, for sure. I hate to admit how much I just want background music sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the time, but, like, yeah, maybe I've just grown soft in my old age, but I'm not quite, like, I don't reach for lightning bolt quite the way I used to.
Right.
Sure.
Well, exactly. On a previous episode this season, we revisited Nine Inch Nails, The Downward Spiral,
ooh,
which was a journey
one.
To revisit because, yeah, speaking of abrasive, yeah.
That was
yeah. But as a teenager, I was super into it, so.
Yeah, that's great. But, yeah, I think it's funny, especially living, like, upstate in a very pastoral place, there's sometimes where I put on music that I'm like, I want to revisit this, and that would be a good example of putting on Nine Inch Nails on, like, a beautiful day overlooking like a bucolic forest, and it'd be like, something's wrong here.
Totally. Doesn't quite work.
No.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so nice to catch up with you.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for giving me the chance to talk to you guys and revisit the past.
So that was another episode of Mixtape Memories, and we will catch you next time.
Yay.
Bye.
Bye.